You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, community-supported, solar-powered, awesome radio broadcasting here in the cultural district of Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host today, Monica Hadley. And we have a really wonderful guest with us today who is back in Fairfield after an absence of 20 years, George A. Ellis, who is the editor of a book called A Symphony of Silence, An Enlightened Vision. Now, George Ellis has had a very eclectic career. He introduced the first course on the science of creative intelligence at California State University in Sacramento. He received international recognition as director for the Institute for Social Rehabilitation and for his pioneering research introducing the Transcendental Meditation Program into the California Youth and Adult Correctional Agency, including Folsom and San Quentin prisons. And there's quite a bit in this book about his experiences introducing TM and teaching TM in the prisons, which is fascinating reading. At the request of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, Ellis created educational teaching materials and videotapes for global rehabilitation projects. He published scientific papers and he authored numerous articles about the TM program and human development. His first book, Inside Folsom Prison, was translated into Spanish and French, and he has developed many entrepreneurial private sector companies, developed projects for the Mayan Indians in Guatemala, and has taught in many universities and colleges. Welcome to Writers' Voices, George.
Glad to be here.
And you're calling us today from Boca Raton, I understand.
Yes, Boca Raton, Florida.
But by the time this goes on the air, you'll be in Fairfield. And what brings you to Fairfield this after 20 years?
Well, I'm coming to Fairfield for a few reasons. One is to, after 20 years of being in the private sector, where I utilized some of the profits from our businesses and agricultural businesses to support TM in various projects, I was allowed to have more time available, and so I'm looking to do some projects to help support the TM organization, and I want to meet with scientists and fundraisers and organizers to discuss different designs for implementing some projects in Florida.
Now, George, tell me a little bit about how A Symphony of Silence came to be. What was the impetus for putting this collection together?
I knew Maharishi for more than 40 years. And I had the pleasure of working with him closely for almost 25 years, introducing TM into what I would call the darker corners of society, residential treatment facilities, drug programs, and the like. And in 1984, when he asked me to go to Guatemala to do some programs, I met a beautiful family, the Martinez family, who were pioneers in introducing the TM program in some very adverse situations as it was operating under a dictatorship. And then I traveled to India in 1986 with representatives of the family, and those representatives also were the board of directors and founders of our agricultural projects. And they had taught thousands of people to meditate, from Mayan Indians to government executives. And we went and we spent a couple of months with Maharishi at his educational facility. And towards the end of my visit to India, I was fortunate to have about an hour conversation with Maharishi. And I had a very beautiful experience, let's just say of transcendence, of inner stillness. And I realized that that experience was something that people have throughout their lives. And then I began to think of all the pioneers of this organization, all of the diversity that connected with Maharishi, from legendary musician Paul Horn to an eminent leader, Jerry Jarvis, to philosophers and scientists and literature professors, a couple of which you'll be talking to later. And I realized, as I started to interview and share with them, that every individual, meditating, non-meditating, has had at some point in their life this experience of transcendent, this expanded awareness. And I wanted to put together a book that was very diversified and that reflected this unifying thread of human experience, of inner awakening and expansion of consciousness, which was congruent with a beautiful and wonderful experience of love and inner peace. And so it is this connecting link that belongs to humanity. It is not something new that emerges within every person. And by giving different voices, a symphony of silence, in a sense, is a biographical sketch, not of Maharishi as an individual, but it's a biographical sketch, as he would analyze and want to be interpreted. It's by the legacy that he has left in terms of humanity and knowledge in the world. And that was the motivating element or factor that was the seed that sprouted eventually. And this book really emerged rather than was written. As I was in the process of doing these interviews and talking to all of these pioneers from all over the world, I could see this universal experience, and I felt that the book could act as an instrument in stimulating in people, whether they were meditating or non-meditating, that there was much more to who and what they were. And that was a driving force that pushed me to bring this together. And the second reason was respect. Respect for the commitment of different individuals, whether it was Jennifer Hawthorne, the author of Chicken Soup of the Soul for the Soul, one of the authors, or whether it was Jonathan Shear, a philosopher, or whether it was Dr. David and Dr. Rhoda Orme Johnson, who devoted 20 years to helping build what is now Maharishi University of Management. Each one of them was special. If you've read the book, which I believe you have, author John Anderson, for example, was the former Deputy Attorney General under Bill Clinton in Arkansas. And here is a man who was a graduate of Harvard Law School, an eminent lawyer, now a deacon in the Catholic Church, being interviewed and articulating the synthesis between his inner spiritual evolution and his sense of law, justice, and rehabilitation. He actually wrote the introduction to my first book, Inside Folsom Prison, and he's extremely articulate and exquisite. And the loveliness of Cynthia Johnson, a master's degree in divinity from Harvard, interviewing her father, which was very, very special. Because when she interviewed her father, who was in his 80s, a few weeks or a couple of months after the interview, he passed away.
Oh, my.
But this was very, very special. It was a special story of the love between a father and the daughter who admired him. And the knowledge that was brought out from Arthur Anderson, who was also interviewed by Cynthia Johnson, and her father, in its application to spirituality, religion, and consciousness, is exquisite. So this book, you might say, it's not an introductory lecture. It was meant to be much deeper and much more profound. And it was also written to give a respect that this is not knowledge and experience that is the property of anyone. It is the essence of who we are.
Well, George, when I first heard about the book, I was under the impression that it was primarily a book of people's experiences with Maharishi, you know, their direct experiences. And there certainly is a lot of that in here. But I found more it was really a series of personal stories of these individual lives and not just their interactions with Maharishi, but their, you know, what TM brought to the rest of their life, and even things that are not so much directly related to TM. So it's a very intimate look at people's lives.
You know, you have articulated it precisely, because nobody wants to be preached to. Nobody wants a dogmatic articulation of a point of view. What I hoped and what happened in this book is the sincerity of a natural evolution in people's lives expressed itself. And the experience and the commonality of the experience was important. As you know, there's a chapter in the book where Maharishi has a conversation with Pat Coram. Pat Coram is in the warden's office at San Quentin Prison, and he was given permission to be a speaker at a law and justice conference in Switzerland. And the electricity could be felt in that interview, and the compassion and the love of Maharishi could be felt. In 1970 in Estes Park, Colorado, when I was very young and I was on a training course to be a teacher, my observation was very simple. When I looked at Maharishi, I saw an enlightened person that wanted to bring happiness to the world and eliminate human suffering. And that was the dedication and the purpose and the focus of an entire lifetime. Mm. In all of us, all of the people who had the good fortune to know him, as David Orm Johnson in his interview remarked, his level of consciousness was extraordinary. But his love and compassion was even more extraordinary, which was a reflection of hopefully what people who became teachers of this technique would share with others.
Mm.
And so this book was not just for meditators or teachers of meditation. This book was about what it means to have integrity and what it means to articulate that integrity through action, which eliminates human suffering by bringing some light into areas of darkness. This book is not about one thing. I used the style. I looked at the book Chicken Soup of the Soul, and I saw how it was about stories. And I read The Science of Being and Art of Living by Maharishi, which went from abstract to applied value. And I used a similar design in creating this book because I don't like to be bored.
Right.
And I did not want the reader to be bored. I wanted the reader to be stimulated. I think if you read the beautiful foreword that was written by Art Anderson, he articulates that this book is about legacy, it's about history, it's about inspiration, and it's a knowledge that within itself can stimulate and enliven the inner experience, because for those who have had that experience once in their life of transcendence, just having their attention, even through knowledge, go in that direction, it enlivens that experience again.
Mm-hmm.
And it just is a great gift, not from me, but from the collective consciousness that Maharishi created worldwide in uplifting society and humanity. I'm a very practical person. I have been in private business for 20 years, and I have worked in the nonprofit sector for 20 years, and simultaneously was able to teach the technique. And I've seen it teach people to transform themselves without intellectualism, but spontaneously. You know, there's a lot of research now on post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic stress. And one of my interests, stimulated actually by creating the book and looking at the work of the David Lynch Foundation, was to experiment on how this technique could help people in the law enforcement profession who face traumatic stress of a similar nature as is experienced in the military or anywhere else. They are forgotten warriors, the people in law enforcement. For 25 years, I taught TM to correctional officers and mostly prisoners around the world, and we have the results that shows that it works. But at this point in my life, my interest is shifting to helping those people who protect society other than the military. So this book is comprehensive. I don't know if you saw the beautiful artwork of Deborah Arnold, and I wrote another chapter from Van Gogh to Maharishi, because Van Gogh is one of my favorite artists. And I juxtaposed him with Maharishi because they both sought to bring love, compassion, and solace to others.
Yeah, there was an interesting quote. I can't remember what it is right now, but I remember looking at that chapter from Van Gogh that really struck me.
We're not on this earth to simply be happy, but to surmount the vulgarity of existence in which the lives of most people drags on.
Right.
And that's what Maharishi did.
Yeah.
The difference is Van Gogh, he experienced transcendence. And when he experienced transcendence, it transformed his art. But then he didn't have any technology to integrate it and develop it in his life, and he didn't have an intellectual understanding. I think one of the great gifts that Maharishi gave people and society, those with an open mind, is the intellectual understanding of their experience. Because there's a beautiful chapter in the book by these Catholic nuns, the Seneca Sisters. And they were, this was in the 1970s, and they were observing courses on transcendental meditation at their facility, and how people were in their rooms in quiet meditation, and they didn't understand how they could keep the people in the rooms, because they couldn't do it when they would offer retreats. So they asked to learn to meditate. And the one nun was 83 years of age, and she asked me a question. She said, "I think I have insomnia." And I asked her about her experience, and she said, "Well, I'm witnessing myself sleep at night. I wake up full of energy and bliss." I said to her, "You don't have insomnia. You're subtle. You're resting in the infinite." And it is just that intellectual understanding that Maharishi provided that is a blessing beyond description for people in all walks of life, especially people seeking to expand an understanding of themselves, not just on a superfluous cognitive level, but on the level of who they are and the essence of what they are.
Well, you point out in the book that when people experience something that's not the norm, whether it's transcendence or cosmic consciousness or whatever it is, that there's a little bit, and I think David Orm Johnson talks about this in his interview too, that we have a tendency to pathologize anything that's not normal. And
yes,
some people
that was a very, very interesting description by Dr. Orm Johnson. And but you know, people fear what they don't understand. People are afraid of change because they think change is going to turn them into something rather than just allow them to be their full value, their full potential as a human being. There's nothing to fear. I've practiced transcendental meditation since 1969. I've taught thousands of people. The youngest was 3.5. The oldest was 86. And I believe the oldest person to learn TM was 127.
Whoa.
And they rode with Jesse James, if I recall. And so anybody can do it. But what's important is that we're not unfolding anything that is already not our own property at birth. We just lose the innocence, and we lose the ability to live what is already there. It seems simple, but stress is our enemy, nothing else.
Well, George, you talked about wanting to work more with post-traumatic stress, and particularly in law enforcement. You spent many years working in the prison systems, and maybe it wasn't called that then, but do you feel like a lot of the inmates were also suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder?
I think most of society is living under some moments of traumatic stress, and that traumatic stress accumulates in their lives. I mean, I once was at Folsom Prison many years ago, and I was actually sitting with a person, and they were rather violent. They were there for the rest of their lives. And when I taught that person to meditate, they just looked at me, and they said, "This is the first time I've relaxed in 13 and a half years." So when you have the accumulation of stress, whether it's in a prison or in society, and you don't have any way to release it, it grows from traumatic stress to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm.
And right now we're just putting labels on it. In the correctional profession, for example, there's a very high percentage of suicides, there's burnout. There's organizational inefficiency, there's escalated violence because of wrong decision-making. Stress is an instrument of incredible destructive power, and many times we try to use cognitive behavioral procedures to eliminate it, and what it does is it ruins the psychology of the mind, and it damages the beautiful delicacy of the heart. What I've always loved about TM is that it eliminates the source of stress without damaging the psychology or the fine feeling level. And I was once teaching a child, a 10-year-old child, to meditate, and I asked him how he felt afterwards. This was a child in a residential treatment facility that people thought was retarded. And he looked at me, and he said, "The trees are prettier."
Aww.
It's a very innocent and simple reflection of truth.
Wow.
The change took place. That 10-year-old child didn't need some psychotherapeutic analysis. He needed an experience of the antithesis of the suffering. It's very simple. You know, the metaphor that is often used, you know, bring light, eliminate darkness. It's a very simple truth. Bring that experience of silence, that stillness, that is the property of everybody. And you cannot have ignorance and knowledge simultaneously existing. Mm-hmm. One has to replace the other. And depending on which is more dominant, that affects the quality of your life.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, when I went to Guatemala, and anytime you'd like to speak to Dominique, just let me know, and I can pass the phone to her. Her family, in the midst of a dictatorship with rebel wars and 600 kidnappings a month had a steadiness. The father was just beautiful. He brought the whole family to learn to meditate. And they inspired a nation, and they helped build in the Mayan Indian villages and the government leadership and business a technology which Maharishi, when he met with them, said had a positive effect in creating coherence in the nation. Mm-hmm. And during that period of time, it transitioned from a dictatorship to a democracy. And there's just many, many stories that family represents in terms of the power of coherence within a family.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is George Ellis, who's the editor/author of A Symphony of Silence, An Enlightened Vision, and we'll be speaking with one of the essayists in that book, Dominique Ellis, in a short time. So stay tuned for that. But first, let's talk a little bit more, George, about how you came to teach TM in the prisons.
In 1971, my first involvement was in the community-centered drug program of the California Youth Authority. The social worker asked me to come and teach the technique. And then, in 1974, I received a call from the Dean of Fine Arts, and he said, we need someone to go and teach philosophy in our college program at Folsom Prison, but nobody will go. I'm afraid to go. And I said, I'll go. And I went, and when I walked through the gates, I got to the education building where I saw there were no ceilings on the classes. And in my first class, my students were Black Guerrillas and Mexican Mafia, Hell's Angels, Nazi Aryan Brotherhood, and Pat Corum. And they just watched me teach for a semester, and they came and they asked me to learn to meditate. So I wanted to be sure they were sincere, so I had them pay the course fee for themselves at the time, like any other citizen. And Pat Corum learned, and then I said, bring me 10 of your leaders in this prison, and let's teach them all. And so members of all those groups that I just described came, and a few others. And then I asked them to write letters to then-Governor Brown. The rest was history. Maharishi heard about it, and he said, okay, let's allow Folsom Prison to be a glass house through which we can see the value of TM in transforming humanity.
Wow.
And it was his compassion and graciousness that allowed that to happen. And then it went to San Quentin, and then Susan W. Gore, a member of the board of directors of W. L. Gore and Associates, heard about the program, and she wanted to do an ideal demonstration project in Vermont, which we did for 3 years. And then it just kept extrapolating, and Maharishi asked me to come to Washington because there were representatives from Brazil and other countries that wanted to introduce it in their countries. And I just wound up writing a manual and other things.
Wow.
And then I went to Guatemala, and there's a prison there called Pavon. And Pavon and the prisons of Central America were quite different. They didn't have guards inside. They had inmates with clubs inside. Their security housing unit was a hole beneath the floor, and they had 25 people in a cell. And we introduced TM and to both the men and the women and Pavone. This was a prison, by the way, that the military had to go in and liberate. So And then what I realized, to make a contribution, we needed to create private sector enterprise, and agriculture was the main work in that part of the world at that time. So we invested in setting up agricultural projects, which became quite successful, international companies, and we used the profits to support various programs in Guatemala and Central America in all sectors of society, especially the Mayan Indians, where they they had a high mortality rate for their children, and nobody thought there was a discrimination in society, that they thought that they couldn't learn, but they could. And they could learn because of the simplicity of TM. It wasn't an intellectualism. It didn't challenge anyone's philosophy or religion. It was a technique. And we taught thousands of these individuals. And I did that for 15 years. And then, around 2007-08, the impulse to do this book came about, and this book was about love and respect. You know, I wanted to honor many people that had created the building blocks that were the instruments. And in a way, the cover of the book is a beautiful flower that was created by George Foster, an artist in Fairfield.
Yeah, he's a master at book cover design.
He is a master, and he got and understood that the essence of the rose was Maharishi. And the petals was the legacy of all the human beings that he had provided and touched and inspired. And those petals were simply dropping on society and creating new gardens and new opportunities for inner awakening.
Now, George,
it's simple.
It seems like you wrote about maybe about a third of the book yourself.
No, the whole book.
The whole book. Well, but there's essays from other people.
Yeah, I guided them.
Okay. So that you did all these interviews and then created the text. Some of it's in interview format. Some of it's in essay format.
Yes.
Right. And
I wanted many more voices than my own.
And then you structured it in an interesting way. And it seems like these are maybe kind of the areas that you see Maharishi is having had a great influence on, I don't know. What did make you choose these areas to structure?
When I was an undergraduate student in the 70s, they were trying to create what they called interdisciplinary studies, in which they were trying to take away the isolation of specialization. And help people to be more comprehensive in their view. Now, when I introduced the science of creative intelligence for general education credit at California University, it was the first time that had been done. And MIU had not really been developed at that time. It was just in the infancy stages. And so Maharishi, when he created MIU, now MUM, he really put a foundation in consciousness, and he showed how consciousness pervaded everything, and that was truly the interdisciplinary link that took away the isolation and the compartmentalization of education and knowledge. When I looked at the science of being and art of living, Maharishi began from the abstract and he went to the applied value. So what I wanted to do in this book was to integrate the abstract with the application and to just highlight, for example, the humanities, literature, art, philosophy, and then spirituality, religion, consciousness, the social implications in terms of all of the applied application, the compassion entrepreneurial support of institutions like the David Lynch Foundation, and then the personal whisperings of inner beauty that emerge from the experience and how it touches people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to create a tapestry. Yes, this is very important to me. I have tried to be a respectful champion of women's rights. And there is a section, and if you look through this book, you will see how many female voices are there. There are many female voices there. And in the one section about the gentle power of women, there's a beautiful artistic rendering by Debbie Arnold of a woman with open hands and butterflies. There is a certain inner strength, for example, in someone like Dominique, who you'll speak to shortly, in the Elizabeth and Patricia Klein, these sisters who went into the prisons with me side by side and changed people's lives. Wow. And Anne Mortefy, the wife of Paul Horn. And there's this woman, Helen Boyce. She's now 94 years of age. I taught her to meditate in 1978, and I was her stock boy when I was in high school. And I taught her to meditate, and with no support, nothing, she just meditated twice a day for 35 years. Wow. And when I talk to her on the phone today, she tells me of her experience of witnessing in sleep, of living in bliss. And that's what growing younger as we become older should be.
And the title of her chapter is Age Does Not Come to Me.
Yes, and it's her words, and she's about as feisty as you can get. She was the Italian matriarch, and nobody messed with her when I was a kid. And here she is, still inspiring people with her own life.
Wow.
Her and her husband had a little grocery store, and they saved her pennies, and she's economically independent. And recently she went to an event, I believe, in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, and they thought that she was going to show up in a wheelchair. They were quite surprised.
I just want to read a little paragraph from her section, from her essay. She says, I am biologically 92 years old, but feel ageless. It is just a number. Age does not come to me. I am comfortable living in the present and not worried about the future. As the days come, I enjoy every day, and enjoyment seems to be my daily and nightly companion. My description of my state of mind is an inner contentment. I do what I feel, not what I have to do. There's nothing I need externally because I'm comfortable with myself. I'm very relaxed. I observe the suffering without judgment, but I choose not to join the suffering. I never looked at Maharishi as a priest or pope. I saw him as an individual who fulfilled himself because of his deep thinking. He was a genius in consciousness. He came into the world and introduced the knowledge and techniques to us. So that's
Helen Boyce.
Yeah, Helen Boyce, 92 years old. Well, let's
92 years young.
92 years young, exactly. Well, let's talk with Dominique a little bit. I'm looking forward to hearing her story.
She's right here,
right.
And she has a beautiful and powerful story to tell. Thank you for this time.
Thank you,
Let me
George.
Give you Dominique now.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is A Symphony of Silence, An Enlightened Vision. We've been speaking with George Ellis, who was the author and editor of this wonderful book. And now we're going to be speaking with Dominique Ellis, who contributed a chapter, and I have a feeling much more to this book. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Dominique.
How are you, Monica?
I am fine. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, certainly. Tell us how you came to be involved in TM and what it has meant in your life.
Well, it was my father. He was the one that introduced us to TM, to the whole family. My father used to be a very special person, looking always for knowledge. And he used to listen in radio program a lot because he was a master tailor. So while he was working, he was always listening to all different types of programs. And it just happened that one morning he was listening to a program related to natural approaches, to natural health approaches, and he heard about transcendental meditation. He was very impressed with the benefits, and he thought that that was something really good for all his children. So when we came back from our different activities during the day, we were all adults and we were already working. When we came back at the end of the day, he said, "I listened to something really good, and I think we should attend to the introductory lecture, and it's going to be on Sunday." So the whole family show up to the small TM center that it was run by a Mexican TM teacher that came to introduce TM to Guatemala. He was in Guatemala City. So it was on Sunday where we attended to the introductory lecture. We were seven sisters and brothers and my father and mother. So the nine people show up at once.
They must have been glad to see you.
And the teacher was so pleased, you know, that whole family was attending to his lecture.
Oh.
And that is how we were introduced to TM.
Now, did your whole family continue to meditate?
Yes. After we attend the introductory lecture, my father asked, you know, what was the procedure, and we were all having different questions because it was so interesting and appealing to us, each one in their own area. I used to be an elementary school teacher, and I had a lot to do and with all my children, and it was long hours of work, and it was very appealing to me that I could get double the rest, you know, that I could get in a regular night sleep. So I said, "This is going to be very good for me, Father." And the same for my other brothers and sisters, you know, in the one area. So he said that you are interested, so you should save until you have your course fee.
And this surprised you. You were surprised by that response.
We were surprised, of course, because somehow we assumed that he was going to pay for us. But he said, if you are interested, you should start to save your money.
And all seven of you did.
Yes, we attended to that introductory lecture in September. He learned right away, my father.
Mm-hmm.
How
about your mother?
My mother learned a little after.
Okay.
But in a matter of 6-8 months. The whole family became meditators.
Wow. Well, it's interesting because, and what year was this?
This was in 1981.
Well, my father became interested in TM shortly after we moved to Fairfield. We moved to Fairfield about a year before MIU came here. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason we moved here was my father was an engineer, but he had a desire to eventually have an organic farm, raise organic produce. And so he had bought some land about 30, 40 miles from Fairfield and had a farm there, but he had a job here in Fairfield. So when MIU came, he became very interested in it because it was a market for his organic produce. And he had his five children all learn TM, but we were younger. We weren't adults. I was maybe 15, my older brother was 16, and then the rest were younger. But there were seven of us that came. And
you were seven, too.
And learned to, five children, two adults, so seven altogether. But I'm the only one who still meditates out of all seven. So it's kind of the same story, but also very different. So now George tells me, and in the book you talk about becoming the national leader of Guatemala, and this was fairly unusual for a woman in Guatemala.
Exactly. Yeah. So you know, it was a kind of very evolutionary time for our family. Because after we all became meditators, the next step was, of course, to become siddhas. And then in 1983, I believe that was when the Utopia course took place, the 7000.
That sounds right.
1983, yes. End of 1983.
Right.
My father attended to that course, and he went to Fairfield. And while he was there, he met with the Governor General for Latin America, and he asked for help to develop the TM movement in Guatemala, because at that time he was the president of the TM Guatemalan Association. So he asked for help, and Benny Feldman said, yes, we're going to make sure that something is going to happen in Guatemala. And so my father came back after New Year's, after the course was finished, and that was in January. And April, a team of pushers came down to Guatemala.
Ah.
A team of pushers came. And they started to have meetings, and my father got involved, very active, finding, making all these different appointments with the government departments and educational departments, all the agriculture, and
were these governmental agencies open to the idea of teaching TM through the government?
They were, and that's why the Bushes did several presentations, and that is when the interest is really was obvious in the in this department for that handling the security of the country, and including the prisons. And that's why they communicated this to Morishi, that it was a very strong interest in. And that is how George Ellis came down to Guatemala.
Ah, and that is how you met George. And you worked with him teaching TM in Guatemalan prisons and to the Mayan Indian population.
I assist, you know, when he came down, I was involved in all the different activities with the provisional TM center that the Grouches put together there. And I was very motivated, you know, and I felt so good to be helping them in the initiations and organizing all the different activities for them. So when George Ellis came down, I was asked by him to assist the whole program as well. I did not go into the precincts. I just helped to coordinate all the different activities and just to facilitate the job for them. So, and when, well, they were taking care of this specific program in the prison, the attention also was spread to different sectors of the society, like all the high school, the homeless, and all the children without parents, all the, we were going to all those different organizations. And at the same time, a massive publication was done through radio, newspapers, and flyers for introducing PM to the whole society of Guatemala. So it was a huge wave of interest in PM in Guatemala.
Wow, and you were right at the forefront of that. That must have been a very exciting time.
I was, yes, I was helping, you know, yes, to coordinate all that. But I was still being a teacher. I was not a teacher. So then George says, we're going to need to have a teacher here in Guatemala, because there was no teachers, in TM teachers in Guatemala. All the ones that came were from El Salvador or Mexico.
Now, what is this? So you no longer live in Guatemala, right?
No.
Now, how long has it been since you've lived there?
Oh, we were there probably in the mid-90s.
Okay. Do you still have do you still have family living there?
Yes, I have. I have brother and sister over there.
And is, I'm just curious as to what the situation is today for the TM movement in Guatemala. Is it still going as strong as it was?
You know, when we left the country, we turned it to a couple of local teachers, because after the three members of the family became TM teachers. And we work hard, you know, in developing the movement in Guatemala. We turned it to the local TM teachers, but and then we moved to the United States. But it seems to be that they didn't follow up. And so it was quiet for many years. But now I understand that there is a strong interest again. And Raja Luis is really putting his attention in Guatemala and Mexico, I believe, and there are several initiations and TMTD programs taking place in certain parts of the country.
Now, Dominique, George has been working on A Symphony of Silence. He worked on it for 4 or 5 years before it was published. How involved were you in that process?
I help him in, because this whole process took several years. The initial idea was to have interviews, and so he interviewed people individually, and then the process of typing the whole interview. So I helped him in that process, and also typing, editing, and making suggestions, you know, how it will look better, the content, and because in an interview is several subjects can be discussed, but when you put that in writing, it's a little different, and it's important for the knowledge to flow.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I help him in that process of editing and putting together the chapters. Of course, he is the one that did the whole job here. So, I just help a little bit.
How does it feel now to have this big project finished and out in the world?
It's a very sweet feeling.
Oh.
It's a very sweet, after several years of putting together, working long hours, in putting together this this project, it came out so nice. It's very nice to hear the comments of all the different people, not only meditators, TM teachers, but people out there, you know, regular people. It's touching different hearts.
Absolutely. I can see that because there's, you know, even if you're not all that interested in or don't have any experience with TM, it's interesting to see what people have devoted their lives to. You know, here's something that people across a wide spectrum of society have devoted their lives to. What is it? What's the reason? What has called people to this? It's just interesting to read about that, even if you don't think you have any interest in TM.
Yes, and especially George wants this to the message to reach all different levels of the society and different languages. That's why he is working in translating this book in different languages.
Now, will you be in Fairfield in July too?
I'm sorry?
Will you be coming to Fairfield in July also?
No.
Okay.
No, I have other commitments, and so I told George that I was going to miss.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Writer's Voices. We're actually running out of time. Do you have any last words you'd like to say about the book?
I just want to say that this whole book and this whole knowledge that it was put together in Symphony of Silence, It was just an expression of love and acknowledgement to the beautiful knowledge that Maharishi gave us.
Thank you, Dominique. That was Dominique Ellis, one of the contributors to A Symphony of Silence and Enlightened Vision, which are tales, stories about people's lives, how they've been affected by transcendental meditation and by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. It's a tribute to him and to the legacy that he's left behind. Thank you so much for joining us today on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.